6, and I think Senator Cohen was also supposed to be here, and constitutional amendment, et cetera. Senator Bach.
Madam President, there's an A3 amendment. It's a delete all. This is the first committee with jurisdiction. I'd like to get the bill in the shape I'd like it to be in.
Okay, we do have the A3 amendment. Does somebody want to offer that?
So moved.
Moved.
I think the loudest voice was Senator Scalzi's. Senator Scalzi moves the A3 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. You didn't find my gavel. It's in my office.
The A3 is adopted.
Okay. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, what the bill now as amended does is makes it slightly more difficult for the legislature to put amendments on the ballot. And what it does is requires a three-fifths vote, 60%, the same that we require for bonding to put the state in debt, of both bodies of the legislature. It requires them to pass the proposed amendment in different years, so they can't both act the same year.
Yes.
And it requires an intervening election before it actually goes to the voters.
Senator Cohen, why don't you join Senator Bach? Because you have very similar bills.
Okay. So that's the guts of the bill, and this isn't. And Senator Cohen and I are going to differ on this. My description of why I'm here. This was a bill that I had in 2010, and the reason that I offered it in 2010, and I believe this committee passed it out and sent it to Rules. And for whatever reason, Senator Pogemiller, who chaired Rules at the time, decided not to act on it and put it on the ballot in 2010. What, if I could back up, my impetus for the bill started in 2007. In 2007, there was a bill floating around here, a constitutional amendment that became known as the Legacy Amendment. 0.3% increase in the sales tax to fund a bunch of things. And that bill was in front of the Tax Committee. Senator Pogemiller was the author, and it failed. And every week, Senator Pogemiller's office came to me and said, when are we going to take the bill up again? And I said, tell me when you have the votes. We'll take it up again. They never were able to get the votes to get the bill out of the Tax Committee as a constitutional amendment. And because the Tax Committee felt pretty strongly that tax increases don't belong in our Constitution. That's not where we put them. It takes too much power away from future legislatures. And so after it sat there 6 or 7 weeks, at the urging of the Majority Leader, we finally took it up. The Tax Committee amended that constitutional amendment to be a statutory tax increase, that we increased the sales tax by 0.3%. Nobody disagreed that those things weren't important to fund, but the feeling was it doesn't belong in the Constitution. So we amended it in the Tax Committee, where I was the chair, sent it to Rules. Rules amended it back to be a constitutional amendment. Unprecedented for the Rules Committee to amend bills. Just doesn't happen. But that's what happened. It then passed the legislature with a bipartisan vote, went onto the ballot in 2008, and is now in our Constitution. So I felt strongly enough about it that I decided to take a look at what's been happening with constitutional amendments. And the research that I did, I discovered that at that time, in 2010, 17 of the last 18 constitutional amendments that were offered passed. And I think that's contrary to what legislators believe. I think there's been a notion around here that constitutional amendments are really hard to pass because we have this threshold of more than 50% of the people that actually voted, not those that voted on the question. But the...
Vice versa. 50% of those who voted on the question, not just on the voted, right?
It has to be 50% plus one that voted in the election, not that voted on the ballot measure.
Oh.
So it is a higher threshold. But members of the legislature during my time here have always talked about how hard it is to pass constitutional amendments. But when I went back and looked in 2010, 17 of the previous 18 passed. From 1982 to 2010, only one amendment that was on the ballot failed, and it was Paramutual Horse Racing in 1994. So that research caused me to think, well, if they're that easy to pass, if the Constitution's that easy to amend, somewhere we have to put some safeguards in place so that we make sure we have broad bipartisan support for giving the voters an opportunity to vote on amendments to the Constitution. And I think the history prior to 2012 was somebody comes here with an idea, and 2008 was certainly like that, and they come with a campaign prepared. And once they get their proposal on the ballot, there's a well-funded campaign that spends millions of dollars to advocate for their constitutional amendment, and oftentimes the other side, the no side of the amendment, there's no campaign. And that certainly was the case of the legacy amendment in 2008. They ran a very, very good campaign, and I don't want anybody to think we're not doing good work with that money. We are. I supported a statutory increase in that sales tax to do what they're doing today. But they ran a very, very good campaign after they passed the legislature. They went out and focus grouped it all across the state to develop a message that they knew would resonate with the public, and what they found was clean water. Everyone wants clean water. And if you remember, the TV ads was all about clean water, because they knew that if they could put that in the minds of voters, that that's what this amendment is all about, is clean water, that they'd have a good chance of passing it. And in 2008, it actually received more votes than President Obama did. It turned out to be a very successful campaign, well-funded campaign, with a message the public supported. But there was nobody telling the other side of the story, because there was no campaign to educate the voters of why that's problematic. So after that happened, I thought, you know, if that's the way amendments are going to run, where one side funds the whole thing and the public only hears one side of the story, then at a minimum, can't we make it a little harder at the legislature to get something on the ballot? And that was the reason I had the bill in 10. That's the reason I'm in front of you today. Clearly, in 2012, the amendments on the ballot that time didn't play out that way. There actually were two sides in the two constitutional amendments in 2012, and they both ended up failing. But prior to that, 17 of the previous 18 had passed. So I think it's an important conversation for this legislature to have. I just think amending the Constitution is really, really important business. And unfortunately, sometimes the public doesn't get to hear both sides of the question. So with that, Madam Chair, those are my thoughts of why I'm here, and be happy to have any questions. Senator Cohn's bill is very similar. I'm sure he's probably got some comments for the reason that he's here with one.
Before we take Senator Cohen's comments, we do have a technical correction on the A3 amendment on line, page 1, line 25. The point 14 should be point 15, and we'll just incorporate that into the amendment. We'll just make that correction. Do we need to vote? Why don't we have a vote, just to be sure?
We adopted it.
At the point 15. It was just. We should vote. Okay. Senator Eaton moves on line 1, page 25, to delete point 14, insert point 15.
We don't get to debate?
Sorry, what?
I said we don't get to debate.
Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any questions for Senator Bach right now? Why don't we hear from us? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Bach, what other states have this similar requirement of 60% for their constitutional amendments by the legislature to go forward? Do you know offhand what those?
No, I don't know. There are states that have higher thresholds than the 50% we have. There are states that have just a simple majority of those that voted. I think it's probably all over the map. Some states have initiative and referendum. And there's a lot of different provisions. I didn't research what other states have, but I think that's good information. Probably should have before we ever, you know, move the bill out of the Rules Committee into the floor. I think that's a question we need to kind of be prepared for.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My interest, as expressed in Senate File 6, is not dissimilar from Senator Bach's. First of all, in response to Senator Anderson, take it back a step. I'm not sure because I don't have everything with me, but I believe there are only about 20 states where you go through the legislature to place an amendment on the ballot. Most of it's through the initiative and referendum process in other states. So you have that direct petition via the ballot. But I'm not quite sure of it. but don't hold me to that exactly. Senator Bach's correct. We need, once we hit the Rules Committee, if that's where these bills are to go, we need to make sure we have all of that information laid out in great detail. Just with Senator Bach a little bit. Now, Senator Bach and he and I have had these conversations relative to the legacy amendment. Obviously, I was strongly on the other side for other kinds of reasons. My bill calls for a two-thirds vote by each body of the legislature. Why two-thirds? Senator Bach's got a 60% vote.
Three-fifths.
Very simple. 60%. That's what's in the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution requires, before an amendment goes back to the states for ratification, the U.S. Constitution requires a two-thirds vote of both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. And my feeling was, if it's good enough for the Constitutional Convention of 1787, it's good enough for us. There was an amendment, if you go back a number of years ago, that I was supportive of, and I think when I was in the House, it was still kicking around, which never got a two-thirds vote in either body, or I don't even think it came. One year might have come close. And that was the Equal Rights Amendment. And I'm a very strong proponent of that amendment. In fact, up until recently, I authored the Equal Rights Amendment as recently as 2 years ago. Now, it's not had a hearing, and it's been there without the expectation that it would be passed out of a session of the legislature necessarily. But that was never able to muster anywhere close to two-thirds. Couldn't come close to 60%. Obviously, it didn't have 50%. So what's concerned me, so I've been on both sides of the issue in that regard. What concerns me is that when we have had amendments historically, and the legacy amendment is an example, if Senator Bach's threshold were to be the threshold, the legacy amendment would have passed both houses of the state legislature because it had a significant bipartisan vote in both the House and the Senate on the bill itself. Generally, that's been the history. And if you look back at some constitutional amendments that have been considered to be more difficult or where there was a greater division, an example, and I was not in the legislature then, but I believe in 1979 or 1980, the legislature put on the ballot a constitutional amendment for initiative and referendum. At the time, as I recall my history, it was viewed as a more conservative effort as opposed to a more liberal effort. It was passed by a House that was either tied or was by a vote DFL majority, and a Senate that clearly was very strongly DFL majority, and was then placed on the ballot. It was defeated, I believe it was the 1980 election, where it was defeated in a very close vote. But initiative and referendum was something that clearly had significant bipartisan support in the state legislature. And my feeling is before we start amending the legislation, the Constitution, we should make sure that the legislation, the initial legislation, has that kind of bipartisan support. And there's no question, kind of the elephant in the room, if you allow me, is, in all honesty, and obviously I was on the opposite side of these amendments, is when we placed amendments on the ballot in 2011 and 2012, it was done on, as we all, those of us who were members of the legislature, it was clearly done on a partisan basis. And we can get into a debate about whether, you know, the plurality in politics and why we're not doing things on a more bipartisan basis. Putting that aside, it seems to me that if we're going to amend the Constitution, that should be on a bipartisan basis. And that we should not have constitutional amendments end up devolving into partisan fights. And again, I'm going to just offer a distinction with Senator Bach that the legacy amendment, which I think people in retrospect think was a partisan fight, was not. Now, it was not unanimous by any means. In fact, Senator Bach's a good example of that. There was clearly some significant DFL opposition. There was some significant Republican opposition. But there was also some very strong, obviously, DFL and Republican support. I think in the Senate, I think there were somewhere 10 to 12, and if there are members, I'm kind of looking around the table as to who was a member of the Senate then, particularly on the Republican side. I think the Republican caucus that year in 2012 2007-2008, because that was subsequent to the 2006 election. You know, we had, I think the caucus was about 20 members or so, and we had half or more of the Republican caucus supporting the legacy amendment. We had a slightly greater percentage of the DFL caucus supporting that amendment, more like two-thirds of the DFL caucus. But it clearly was a bipartisan vote. And so my thought is, before Senator Bach has talked about the votes we get, you know, the votes that are taking place on the part of the public, and that we should increase the threshold, I agree with that. I'm not necessarily wedded to the two-thirds figure as opposed to the 60% figure, but I think that allows us to have a stronger base of support. And my two-thirds figure I derived from simply the U.S. Constitution. So that's my rationale for the bill.
Madam Chair, I did have had staff put in everybody's packet this House research, Minnesota Constitutional Amendments, History and Legal Principles, done by House Research back in March. And Senator Anderson, you'll see on page 5, yep, there is a comparison. Connecticut actually requires 3/4. 9 states require 3/5. 17 require 2/3. So there's a number of different ways states do it. So that's, I think, if you're the information that you requested is probably in that,
right
in
there,
that brief. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm not necessarily wed to the 60%. If this committee thinks it should be 2/3, 60% is just something I came up with just because that's what we require to put the state in debt. But if people want 2/3, I'm not adverse to that. Senator Cohen might reconsider his position when you look at that House research document. I noticed the legacy amendment did not have the 2/3 it would have needed in the House to have ever got to the ballot. 2/3 of the vote in the House is 90 votes, and it had 85 votes in the House. In the Senate, 2/3 is 45, and it had 46 votes. So it would have passed in the Senate, but it would not have met the 2/3 threshold to have passed in the House. 2/3 is a pretty high threshold.
I think also the idea of it passes in one House and then the second House the next year.
Right.
You can't do them both in one calendar year. And it has to be, though, within the 2-year period, right? Does that mean it has to be in the same session, biennial session, or it could be different biennial sessions?
Well, council maybe could help us, but I would think it would have to be by the same legislature. So
okay,
we operate in a biennium. So I would say one would have to pass it in the first year of the biennium, the other one in the second year of the biennium.
Is that clear, you think, in there? Ms. James.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, and members, we could add some clarifying words to make it absolutely clear. The first sentence provides for it to be 3/5 of the members elected to each house of the legislature. So that's open to an interpretation that the legislature is for a biennium, and so that would be 2 legislatures if it went into the next biennium.
Mm, okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my first question is, this is a change to the Constitution. Is that what we're doing here?
Yes.
And to change the Constitution, don't we have to have a constitutional amendment to do that?
Yes.
Okay, so this is to put it on the ballot as a constitutional amendment.
Right.
It's line, not just statute,
if you look on the delete all amendment on line 116, 115, submission to the voters in the 2014 general election.
Madam
Give
Chair.
Give a copy of the A3.
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I contemplated just a statutory change, and because that would actually be my preference, but a future legislature could simply do a notwithstanding clause to current law and then ultimately put something on the ballot with, you know, a one-vote margin. And those of us that have been around here a while have seen a lot of legislation written notwithstanding other provisions.
And Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, what I didn't have previously what Ms. Kaplan just handed to me was what I've been looking for was a breakdown of some of the recent constitutional amendments, which I think make the case. Senator Bach pointed out that the legacy amendment passed the Senate on a vote of 46-17. It was more heavily weighted on the DFL end of it, but clearly was a bipartisan vote. By contrast, and I would have been on the opposite side of this one, in 2005, the amendment to dedicate the motor vehicle sales tax to highways and public transportation passed the Senate 36 to 31. DFL, yes, 35. Republican, yes, 1. Republican, no, 31. DFL, no, 0. So having suggested some criticism of what took place in 2011 and 2012, let me shift the criticism back to my caucus. And clearly I would have been voting the majority on that constitutional amendment. I would have been one of the 35 Democrats. There were no Republicans voting, no Democrats voting no. So the same argument can be made in that case. By contrast, here are some of the other votes on constitutional amendments recently. 57 to 8, this is in the Senate, 62 to 3, 63 to 2, 58 to 0. Another exception, 1996, to provide for recall of elected state officials. That passed the Senate on a vote of 34 to 30. Republican, yes, 0. Republican, no, 26. DFL, yes, 34. DFL, no, 4. That's another amendment that did not pass on a bipartisan basis. So I've given you 4 amendments, you know, 2 of more are of more recent vintage, but I've given you 4 amendments, 2 in a Republican majority Senate and 2 in a DFL majority Senate, where the 4 amendments passed clearly on what was basically a partisan vote, and without that supermajority, whatever that percentage might be, 60% or 67%.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Personally, if we're going to do this, I would like to see Senator Bach's 60%, 3/5. I think the question here should be a philosophical one. Obviously, we're all going to have differences on which amendments we're glad they did or didn't get on the ballot, but really the question here is on the really controversial, tough issues in our society. Are the people going to decide it or not? Because if we set the threshold to 2/3, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to ever get a ballot measure passed through this legislature. Even at 60%, it's going to be really tough. So I'll be honest with you. I haven't thought a lot about this before because I wasn't in the legislature in 2010. That's the year I was elected the first time. But to me, I think the thing people have to consider is what we're really deciding here is when it comes down to the controversial, gut-wrenching issues in our state. Do we want to likely submit them to the people or not? Because with a 60% threshold, it's going to be much less likely that we'll ever get it to the people, and with a 2/3, nearly impossible.
Senator Cohen.
I'm sure it's Senator Thompson, because obviously that's offered as a criticism of the bill I have. And I'm not necessarily in disagreement. I could certainly accept Senator Bach's bill. But again, I do need to make the point when we talk about having the people decide and so on. My 2/3 figure, whether it's a realistic figure in the context of 2014 or not, is a figure that I came to and utilized from the U.S. Constitution. And if you read the debates of the Constitutional Convention as to why they looked at a 2/3 figure, now, understandably, things were different, you know, the folks at that convention did not have the expectation that you would have the popular vote in many respects that you have today. But they were looking for higher thresholds for what they considered to be significant changes to basic governmental structures, such as the Constitution.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, not meant to be too harsh a criticism, certainly reasonable minds can differ on this. I'm simply pointing out that if we go to the 2/3, it becomes nearly impossible to submit a controversial issue to the public. Whether or not that's a good thing, each member will make their own mind up. And I guess the reason I wouldn't necessarily rely upon the analogy to the federal government, to the United States Constitution, is historically and philosophically, the states are supposed to have more powers, more latitude than the federal government. The federal government, unfortunately, it doesn't work this way, but they're supposed to be limited to the Article 1, Section 8 powers of Congress. And it's a shorter document than almost all state constitutions. So I think it is not necessarily unreasonable to have a lower threshold in the state, but certainly, like I said, reasonable minds can differ.
And Madam Chair, I understand the argument. And like I said, I'm not, if the majority of the Senate were to feel that the 60% threshold is a more realistic one for the reason you state, that I would find acceptable. Madam Chair, I realize this would get a little obscure. Senator Thompson and I will debate this privately later. what you've suggested is contrary to the thrust of the Constitutional Convention of 1787. If you read the original debates and the folks who were carrying the day at that convention, they were the ones who wanted a stronger federal government. The people like George Mason, Edmund Randolph, Elbridge Gerry were all on the losing side of the debates and the decisions made by the Constitutional Convention. But that's a subject for a different day with Senator Thompson.
Okay. Boy, is it ever.
Sounds good.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach, I just wanted to ask Senator Housley, because you had a similar bill. Did you have your threshold at the 60% or two-thirds?
60%.
60%. Mm-hmm. Maybe 2-1, Senator Cohen. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, many of us describe Senator Cohen as the historian of our caucus. Perhaps if you have such a creature in your caucus, we could get the two of them together, and they could swap some stories from our founding fathers and the Federalist Papers.
Well, I wanted to propose, first of all, on Senator Bach's amendment, Senate Counsel did have a suggestion on line 1.9 after the, we insert same. That would clarify that it's the other house of the same legislature in the next calendar year. And does someone want to offer that amendment?
So moved.
Senator Hayden moves to insert same after the on line 1.9. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevailed. At least we didn't say such legislature. We're channeling Senator Frederickson. I just wanted to propose this to see what members think, is if we would pass out Senate file number 4 as amended, and then we could add Senator Cohen and Senator Halsley's name to the bill, perhaps, and make it a kind of a joint effort with all three authors together. Senator Cohen, the other option would be to send them both to rules.
I think
you wanted them both
Madam
to
Chair,
rules.
I think the issue is, I'm not sure which bill the House is going to move because they have both sets of jackets.
Okay.
And I think we want to make sure that in the Rules Committee, which is the last stop before it goes to the floor, that it matches up with what set of jackets the House is moving. And I don't know which one they're going to move. So just to be safe, I think it's probably better to send both of them to Rules, and then we'll pick up the one that if the House moves a bill.
I
don't know if they're going to.
If the sentiment of this committee, though, is to go with 60%, should we then amend Senate File number 6 as well, members? Because we could add the, the A3 amendment on Senate File 6.
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Cohen, do you have any preference? Oh, yes,
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Johnson.
Is the author's wish?
Madam Chair, if the wish of the committee is to use the 60% threshold, I'll just have to take that up privately with the founding fathers someday.
Yes.
And would defer to the committee's judgment in that regard.
Okay. There's another same we have to add on page 1.21 after the first the, insert same. Senator Thompson, do you want to offer it this time? Senator Thompson moves that language. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
On 1.21 after the.
Yes.
Of the A3 amendment?
Of the A3 amendment, that's right. So it's House of the same legislature in the next calendar year.
Of the same legislature.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator,
Madam Chair,
Cohen.
If the committee would feel happier relative to Senate File 6, my bill, which is a little bit simpler, to simply on line 1.9 and 1.18, change the two-thirds to 60% if that's the committee's wish, and that's the easiest way then
to show
the committee to deal
right,
with the issue.
To show our intention.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, why don't we do that when we'll take up your bill next. Do that. Any other questions on the A3 amendment or on the issue?
On the issue, but not on the A3.
Okay, Senator Hall.
My question, probably Senator Bach, your argument on so many bills being partisan bills, and you're concerned about that over the years. If this bill becomes a partisan bill, to get passed, would you withdraw it then?
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I would hope to be able to have a conversation with some members of the Republican caucus. I know Senator Halsley has a bill that's very similar. I know I've had conversations with Senator Anderson. When I introduced the bill last year, came to me and said it. If it was a constitutional amendment, he'd be interested in signing on it. So I think there's some support in both caucuses, but I sure would like to see 41 votes for the bill if we brought it to the floor, which is what it would take in order to have 60%. I think it would send kind of a bad message if we didn't have 41 votes, 60% for what we're proposing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Good point.
I'll take that as a yes.
I think we can get there.
I'll take that as a yes.
Okay. Anyone want to move the bill? Why don't we let Senator Halsley?
I'll move the Senate File 4.
Okay. Senator Halsley moves that Senate File 4 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Rules Committee. Is there any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bach. And then on Senator Cohen's bill, someone else want to move that?
Madam Chair, did you want to amend it?
Yes, the amendment. I'm sorry. Someone want to move an amendment?
I'll move the amendment.
Senator Johnson moves that on Senate File 6, line 1.9, to delete two-thirds and insert 60%, and on line 1.18 to delete two-thirds.
I want it to be three-fifths.
Sorry. Three-fifths. I'm corrected. And on line 1.18, delete two-thirds and insert three-fifths. Is there any discussion on that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Would someone like to move this bill? Senator Wicklin?
Sure.
Okay. I thought you raised your hand.
Yes.
Senator Wicklin then moves that Senate File 6 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
All right, thank you. Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1952, Senator Metzen and Mr. Hubinger. And it looks like we have an A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment.
Governor changes.
Oh, yeah.
Senator Eaton moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Metzen.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1952 ratifies the collective bargaining agreements with the state employees. These agreements have been given interim approval by the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. These agreements provide modest salary increases for our state workers. These employees have stuck with us during the recession for 3 years, and more than half of our employees didn't get a raise at all for 3 years. So I'd like to think that they helped the state and everybody through this recession and were helpful in that regard. At the same time, these our employees are facing increased health insurance costs due to increases in their co-pays in addition to not getting getting a raise for those 3 years. And in order to remain competitive and attract a high-quality state workforce, we need to provide these modest increases, in my opinion. The bill ratifies 8 to 11 contracts, 3 compensation plans with state employees in the executive branch, and also approves salaries for agency heads. In fiscal year 14, provide a 3% across the board increase, and July 1st of, let's get these dates straight, 3% across the board increase effective July 1, 2013, and again July 1 in 2014. In addition to this, the employees will be asked to pay an additional 5% of the cost of their health insurance and continue to pay 15% of the family premiums. Let me go through the agencies that are involved. Law enforcement, St- state troopers, conservation officers, and BCA agents, and there are 1,717 people in that category. Subdivision 2 deals with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5, which provides a 3% increase for 15,700 people. Subdivision 3 deals with American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees and Radio Communication Operators. There, and there's 200, or in Unit 225, which covers approximately 56 radio communications people. The next one, Subdivision 4, is American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, which includes corrections officers. And this provides a modest increase for 1,993 employees. Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, that's MAPE, covers approximately 13,000 professional employees. Subdivision 6 deals with Middle Management Association. This collective bargain agreement covers approximately almost 3,000 people. Subdivision 7 is the commissioner's plan. This compensation plan establishes terms and conditions of employment for about 1,180 unrepresented employees, including confidential staff, medical specialists in this plan. Subdivision 8 is a managerial plan. The managerial plan establishes terms and conditions of employment for about 1,330 unrepresented managers, including deputies and assistant commissioners, bureau heads, and division directors. Subdivision 9, Minnesota Governor, Government Engineering Council, engineers primarily employed by the Department of Transportation. There are about 970 employees in this area. Subdivision 10 is the State Residential Schools Education Association. This division covers about 188 teachers, which includes the act, the Deaf and the Blind and the Perpich Center for the Arts Education and the Department of Human Services people. Subdivision 11 deals with the Office of Higher Education, unemployed plan. This compensation plan defines terms and conditions of the employment for approximately 45 unclassified people. 12 to 14 deals with the state pension fund director's salaries. These three subdivisions pay ratified increases for the directors of state retirement association. I think a few years back when we did the director and another one or two, I think at the time we should have probably put these employees in there, but we didn't. Again, these contracts have been negotiated in good faith by Minnesota management and the employee unions. And I, for one, would like to respect the bargaining unit process. These contracts and plans provide modest increases in compensation for our valuable state employees. Again, I think they stood up and understood for 3 years that they have to be part of the bite of the apple to slow down the spending in the state, and I believe that they are ready for a little bump right now. So it's a good contract, I believe, and I would ask for your support. Greg Hubinger is a director. He's at my side here in case we need additional thoughts on any questions you may have.
Senator Mitzen, would you tell us, Mr. Hubinger, what the A1 amendment does?
Madam Chair and members, last year the legislature adopted legislation that gives the governor the authority to set the salaries of agency head commissioners anywhere within their approved salary ranges. The amendment would require that the governor, when he or she changes them, to notify the legislature.
That's good. Any questions from members of the committee? You know, that last bill, I forgot to ask if there was anyone who wanted to testify. People are here. Be sure you raise your hand if you want to testify. There may have been people who wanted to testify on the constitutional amendment. Is there anyone who wants to testify on this bill?
Only if they're for it.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, people do call and let the staff know if they want to testify, but I should still ask. Okay. No questions from members of the committee? All right. Senator Eaton, you want to make the motion? You're a co-author. And you're on the Compensation Council, too, right?
Yes. Madam Chair, I move that we pass this bill.
Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 1952 is amended, be recommended to pass. Any more discussion?
Probably have to go to Finance Committee.
It goes to Finance, right.
Did we move the amendment?
Yes, we did. It was an author's amendment. It does have to go to Finance. Thank you. Recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any more discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. We're moving right along here. I didn't read it. Senator Rosen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members.
Yes, Senator Rosen, welcome to the committee.
I appreciate the hearing. Madam Chair and members, we have Senate File 404, which is the Music Therapy Licensure Bill. And basically, for those that are unfamiliar what this health occupation is, it's the definition, it's a clinical and evidence-based use of music interventions to accomplish individual goals within a therapeutic relation by a credentialed professional who has completed an approved music therapy program. So we're in front of course, your committee, Madam Chair, because of Section 2. The services that the music therapists provide are in skilled and intermediate care facilities, adult foster care homes, rehabilitation hospitals, residential care facilities, hospitals, adult daycare centers, retirement facilities, senior centers, hospices, psychiatric treatment centers, senior evaluation centers, and they have a strong work in the Alzheimer's with Alzheimer's patients. There are 70 approved music therapy programs in the nation, which all receive a national examination administered by the National Commission for Certifying Agencies, which afterwards they receive a MTBC, which is a Music Therapist Board Certified degree. You can get this four-year degree from either University of Minnesota or Augsburg here in the state. This bill was brought forward by the AMTA, which is American Music Therapy Association, which there is currently 223 music therapists living and working in Minnesota, and they have served over about 52,000 people have received services from music therapists. They have 1,200 hours of clinical training with at least 180 hours of pre-internship experience and 900 hours of internship experience approved by the academic institution and the American Music Therapy Association. They have to go through an extensive background check, and there's some reciprocity issues in the bill. They do have a waiver for the exam for up to 1 year. If every 5 years, it has to be renewed, the licensure. So with that, Madam Chair, as I said, there Section 2 is primarily what's before you, and there is a A4 amendment that was brought forward by council to really tighten up that section better. And if I may, Madam Chair, does everybody have the amendment?
We're just passing it out.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Well, basically, the original part of the bill goes through who can be a member and how it didn't really jump into how the terms are going to flow and no expiration point. And perhaps I should wait just a second until everybody gets it in front of them. But right now, there is one member who is a licensed healthcare professional who is not a music therapist. There's also a member who is a consumer, and the amendment would change a consumer of music therapy. And also three members would be on this council, this advisory council, for who practice in the state, who are music therapists that are in the state. It also provides, it organizes the committee under the statute 15.059 and provides for a four-year term and provides for two of the members to have terms coterminous with the governor and the others to have terms that end a year later. And it also makes an exception for the initial appointees because it needs to account for the partial year up before the governor's term starts. So it also states on the amendment line 15 through 17 that the chair must be elected by the other members. And line 18 of the amendment also sets an expiration date of June 30th of 2022. And as council informed me, which I was not aware of, that this is standard language to make sure that they can come back and say this is working and we want to continue our licensure, or perhaps this is not necessary and we don't need to go forward. So basically the A4 is just listing the terms and making the initial appointments, the transition for those initial appointments.
So under our jurisdiction is basically the Music Therapy Advisory Council, and that's
right.
Why our
Section
council looked at conforming the language with our guidelines. And you've come from another committee, so I'm glad you explained that amendment first. And you are going from here to finance.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, there's fees attached to this. Of course, it's a license board. So, and I do have Todd Schwartzberg and Amy Mattson with me that can.
Okay.
Amy Furman, excuse me, Furman, that could briefly talk about why we need a licensure if you are interested in.
Why don't we add the A4 amendment? Does someone want to offer the A4 amendment? Senator Eaton moves the A4 amendment. Are there any questions on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. You could, as long as you made the trouble to be here, certainly you can address us briefly, but really we're just looking at the need for an advisory council.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon.
Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Oh, I am so sorry. I'm Todd Schwartzberg, and I am a music therapist and professor of music therapy at the University of Minnesota. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. As Senator Rosen has said, our hope for this licensure in the state of Minnesota is to ensure that the quality of services delivered by a music therapist, to ensure that those who are receiving music therapy are receiving those from a board-certified music therapist in the state, to ensure that the quality that they are receiving is the highest quality possible, guided by, of course, our national governing bodies, the American Music Therapy Association, and the Certification Board for Music Therapists.
Any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schwartzkopf?
Schwartzberg.
Schwartzberg. I see in this here you've got a code of ethics for the American Music Therapy Association, and I'm guessing that these are things that you as music therapists have to abide by. Do we as a state have to be concerned about doing an investigation into your background as far as criminal background or things like that, and for us to be concerned? I mean, you've got this code of ethics. I'm wondering, as a state, should we be, do other states have similar type situations where they have code of ethics, and do they have to do background checks also?
Mr. Schwartzberg.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator. At this time, I do not feel as though that the state needs to be concerned that our not only our certification board for music therapists, but also each individual employer that employs a music therapist would do a very intensive background check to make sure that not only the individual is safe and providing a safe service to their clients, but every 5 years, we have to resubmit for board certification to our certification board for music therapists, and that process is done again.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Schwartzberg, then upon doing an interview or an application, you would present that background or those items of investigation that you yourselves policed, that would come forward in an application to whoever is interviewing an individual.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you. If it pleases the committee, we could present, and we could clarify this along with you, we could present at the time of resubmission for licensure a copy of the background check that was done by the facility that the music therapist works for.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schwartzberg, You stated that you want to ensure quality. Is there a problem right now within your therapy groups?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. No, there is no problem with the services that are delivered by a board-certified music therapist. This is a national opportunity that our American Music Therapy Association is undertaking. Currently, three other states have just recently approved licensure in their states. And so this is an opportunity to just make sure in the state of Minnesota that your constituents, our clients, are receiving board-certified music therapy services.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Schwartz, but so what you're telling me is there's not a problem now, but you still would like to put together an advisory council to make sure there won't be a problem. And to me, that sounds like a lot of bureaucracy putting together for something that there could happen.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Hall, for the question. I do have Amy Furman, Ms. Furman here, that could answer that better, but these are people that are coming into your home and are working with very vulnerable people. And so it is like any other occupation. There isn't a problem at this moment, but this is in, I believe, 20 other states that is pending, also this licensure, because it is getting to be a very highly respected type of therapy going forward. And Ms. Furman can actually go into some of the people that have used this therapy that are nationally well-known and where this type of occupation is going.
You want to state your name for the record again?
I'm Amy Furman.
Amy Furman. I actually, even though it's not in our jurisdiction, I also was kind of curious because typically we license if there are health or safety issues involved. So if you could just kind of address Senator Hall's concern and my concern briefly.
I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair. I have been serving music therapy service to Minnesota residents since 1984, and the most compelling reason for the license is to ensure that those services are provided by a board-certified music therapist. As you've heard from Senator Rosen and from Professor Schwartzberg, a board-certified music therapist moves through a four-year educational degree, has training, has practicum, and has an internship service. And while there are board-certified music therapists who meet then taking a credentialed board certification test, there are many people who enjoy music or like music or play music. And there is a very big distinction between a professional board certified music therapist and someone who might come in and simply play for you. And the license lets us speak to our allied health professional colleagues, occupational therapists, speech therapists, nurses, and they know that then the state has looked at and said, indeed, it's the board certification music therapist that protects our clients and your constituents. And that's why we're asking for that, because we found that as we have now a 60 years of research base and evidence-based practices for the work we do, we find that nurses and other place people are starting to refer clients to us, and they're all licensed. And so they, of course, then look to the state of Minnesota and say, are you licensing music therapists also? And so that's why we're here asking you to say that the board certification is the level of expertise that you want working with your constituents and the family members. I think one important point is that most of the people we work with are really vulnerable individuals, and having this protection lets them know that they are dealing with someone who is immensely qualified to provide assistance.
Senator Hall.
Is there, Madam Chair, is there any opposition to the bill?
There are some people who have signed up to testify, I think, in opposition.
Madam
I'll
Chair.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Hall, there was some discussion with a speech pathologist, or speech therapist, I should say, and the physical therapist about language in the bill dealing with collaboration. It is being worked out. Mm-hmm. It is not exactly to the liking, because we can't quite figure out exactly where it should be, because it clearly states in the bill several spots there is collaboration right now. But that being said, we are going to be working on this. And I believe there was some issues from Institute of Justice, I believe, that frankly doesn't just really doesn't care for any licensure type of issues. And that's the only only people that I know of. And if there is more, I hope they come to my office.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, it says in here that this commissioner is a commissioner of health or a designee.
Right.
I wonder what you mean by the designee. That, I mean, I would think commissioner of health would be enough. Why do we have to have a designee?
Madam Chair. And
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, that is very similar in all the other licensure capacity. The department commission or the commissioner of health, it can appoint somebody to basically oversee the council. And as you can imagine, there are many licensures. There's many boards, and so that's just how that department is going to work. But I don't think this language, and I could be corrected, but this is standard licensure language.
Senator Rosen, we've been informed that the Judiciary Committee wants to see your bill. I'm sorry.
It's like the kiss of death. Is there a certain
It's the background check and the penalties.
Right.
That's the sections they'll look at.
Right.
And let's see, Ms. Foreman, did you complete your comments?
Yes.
All right, great. Any other questions for the witnesses? Senator Anderson. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen or whoever. Is this therapy reimbursed by insurance companies?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schwartzberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Yes, according to the American Music Therapy Association, approximately 17% of our board-certified music therapists have received reimbursements for their services.
Okay, thank you very much. Then let's move on to Scott Shoemaker and Mr. McGrath. Are you together or separate? Separate. Okay, Mr. Schumacher then. You can join Senator Rosen at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Scott Schumacher, and I live in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. I am a I'm a web designer, but I also part-time I am an energy body worker. I do Reiki, and I'm also studying sound healing. I'm on the board of an organization that's newly formed 3 years ago called the Shimmering Sounds Foundation. And we actually, I'm here on behalf of me as a citizen, not on behalf of that board entity, but we actually educate and provide outreach opportunities for folks who are studying sound healing and sound and vibrational healing as a form of complementary alternative therapy. I have a pink sheet that I've given you in your packet that kind of comes to you about my opposition to this bill. I call this a small O opposition. And for members of the audience, if you can get that pink sheet on the side of the room as well. My opposition to the bill is that unlike there are three other states in the United States that now have regulated music therapy as a profession, Nevada, Georgia, and North Dakota. All three of those laws now are very different. This is the first, I believe, practice regulating bill. The other bills are registration and title protection. Because this is an actual practice bill, it requires some exemption clauses. And on the pink sheet, I give you some information about Chapter 146A, which was the Minnesota Freedom of Access and Freedom to Practice Complementary Alternative Medicine that passed in the year 2000. And in those 14 years, many other therapies have come forward. We have different types of regulation and nonprofit organizations and 501c6 organizations that oversee membership and practice standards for different complementary alternative therapies. 146A, because in Minnesota, we allow unlicensed complementary and alternative practitioners to practice, and we allow the public freedom of access to them. Some folks who practice sound therapy, vibrational healing, and who use music as an ancillary technique along with their therapy. For example, someone who does community drum workshops, a hypnotherapist who works with sports training or uses sound and isochronic tones or other tones to affect brainwave entrainment. The definition of this law is a practice act rather than just a merely a title protection act. So one of my small opposition was to actually add seven words to an appeal to add seven words to Chapter 3, Subdivision 3, and Item 2 of the language to include occupations regulated under Minnesota Statute 146A in the exemptions clause for this bill. If you're not familiar with Minnesota Statute 146A, under this act, it covers all of the unlicensed complementary alternative therapists, such as reflexologists, hypnotherapists can practice under this law, massage therapists practice under this law, energy healers practice under this law, and we have certain regulations. We are regulated by the states, but we are unlicensed. So I believe five states have this type of freedom of access protection law in place. It is a consumer protection law. If you hold yourself out to be an unlicensed complementary alternative therapist, you must provide a client bill of rights. There is a, let me just read through here. You actually have to provide informed consent, a client bill of rights, adhere to a standard uniform code of ethics and standards of practice that are set forth by Minnesota statute of conduct. So I feel that this law, as written as a practice act, is going to put out a lot of these folks under this 146A who practice under this law. Also,
Mr. Schumacher, were you able to present your proposal to the Health and Human Services Committee when
I was
met?
Not. This was, Madam Chair, thank you. This was the first time that I've heard wind of the bill, okay. And so this is why
I know
I'm
we're
here
moving
today.
Pretty fast
it is moving
this
fast.
Session.
Well, Madam Chair,
yes, Senator Rosa.
This bill is the second year for this bill because the chair of policy was not going to hear any licensure bills last year.
Mm.
So this has this has been a work, but this is a major change, Madam Chair. To what I think the scope of the
well,
bill is.
Well, Senator Rosen, it's not within the purview of our committee to take this up, but I do think that, personally, I think Mr. Schumacher makes a good point that there are these other occupations regulated under Minnesota Statute 146.8. It's really only, it is only those seven words. That it looks like he's adding a lot, but that's in your bill. He's just saying including occupations regulated under Minnesota Statute 146A. So I think that you should have a conversation with Senator Rosen and, you know, convince her that, you know, she could incorporate this into her bill at some other point. But I don't think it's appropriate to do it in this committee today. You know, I mean, committee members are free to offer an amendment if they'd like to, but it's not, we're just usually here to look, we're just here to look at the advisory committee.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Mr. Schumacher.
I do want to just point out that currently two other colleges, Minscu colleges, are offering integrative health programs and sound therapy certificate programs. And if this law, practice law, were to be taken into effect the way it is written right now, that would be in competition with those types of associate and certificate degree programs as written under the law. And so we would be essentially putting this law in competition with Minscu schools in the state of Minnesota, the way these Minscu schools and have created their curriculum that are sub below this bill. It's not a bachelor's level degree. It's an associate's and under.
Well, like I said, I would just suggest that you have a conversation with Senator Rosen after she has a chance to, you know, it's kind of hard on an author when you kind of spring it on them. She just needs a chance to look at it and discuss it with you and with the music therapist people.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, let's move on then to Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Rosen, thank you for the opportunity to testify against Senate File 404 today. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is a not-for-profit public interest law firm. We have lobbied and litigated against occupational regulations. Most recently, we've won a decision in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals against Louisiana's licensing requirement that funeral directors be the only person who could sell casket. So one step below the United States Supreme Court. The Fifth Circuit declared that unconstitutional. Similarly, here in Minnesota, the District Court of Ramsey County has declared unconstitutional a licensing requirement as it relates to embalming rooms. We have long additionally lobbied members of this legislature to enact consider existing policy. This bill, unfortunately, is inconsistent with existing policy in Minnesota codified in Section 214. Madam Chairman, it is the requirements of Section 214 that you consider licensing only when it is required for safety and the well-being of the citizens. And as Senator Hall's comment suggests, one of the sub-criteria for that is that there has to be harm or endangerment of health. But most importantly, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Section 214 also requires that the legislature uses the least restrictive means of addressing questions of real health and safety by requiring that the legislature consider whether, before adopting a licensing regime, whether there were other means that could address the health and safety issue.
Mr. McGrath, did you have an opportunity to testify in the Health and
Unfortunately, health and I did not.
Because it was really their responsibility to determine if there was a health and safety issue here and to move forward with licensing. Our purpose is really to see if the advisory committee is necessary and if it meets our guidelines in terms of how we create these advisory committees and how the memberships are determined, et cetera.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for focusing in on that. This an advisory committee is unnecessary because there is no health and safety issue here. This is an attempt to fence out competitors and not a real health and safety issue worthy of codification in Minnesota law. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Mr. McGrath.
I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Any questions from the committee? Any final comments by Senator Rosen or the witnesses?
Well, Madam Chair, I do appreciate you keeping to the scope of the bill. I do appreciate that. There is some concerns that I think I can address absolutely with this bill and the language. I'm going to need some time, obviously, and I'll have some time before I get to judiciary. But I do think it's a very important bill because, again, like I said, we are working with the vulnerable, a lot of brain traumatic injury folks, and this is we're seeing great results with music therapy, and we just want to make sure that we are continually providing a quality product and care for these folks. And that's
it's actually kind of amazing the impact that music can have. I just wanted to share that my mother has advanced Alzheimer's, but she still remembers the words to a lot of songs, and the kind of the singing session that they have, you know, every day is something that she really looks forward to and is really important to her and kind of keeping her going. Mm-hmm. And she'll be singing the songs for hours after that.
Madam Chair, I believe that if the group wants to police themselves and make sure that they do have a continuum of care with all the other care providers out there, I think this is very important, and that's what this bill does provide.
So basically it doesn't say that, you know, you can't have a song leader that sings songs in a nursing home. You just can't call yourself a music therapist. Correctly.
That's correct.
Ms. Furman, did you want to?
I just was going to say you got that exactly right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
I'd like to move the bill.
Okay. Senator Torres-Ray moves that Senate File 404, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee. Is there any other comments or questions? Anybody else in the audience want to testify? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Well, committee, don't forget my little email of a little surprise for you across the hall. The committee members and the staff are invited to come to my office for